Just to get started by way of announcement, I'll announce it now, and then we'll try to remember to announce it during the devotional period. Remember that we have the Friends and Family Day Sunday, which means that tonight is the last night to voluntarily remove your personal items from the pews. Tonight, after services, we'll be involuntarily moving things out and just making it kind of visitor-friendly. I think I've told you this story before. I can't remember, though, that right after we finished building the new auditorium and had everything set up, and I think we'd had maybe our first service in it, one of the contractors came back by to do something and popped in and came by and stopped and saw me. He said, "Hey, there are blankets and footstools in your auditorium." I said, "That's the way it's going to be from now on. Just heads up." "They stay here?" I said, "Yeah, that's the way it works." So he was really confused by that, but I said, "No, that's the way it works. So that's not a problem. 51 weeks out of the year, but Friends and Family Day, we try to take them home." We are starting a new quarter, and we'll get the new class explained and underway here very quickly. But first, I asked Bobby Hill if he would say a word of prayer for us to get us started. So way back a year ago, when we planned out the education curriculum for this year, we had put into this slot a class on evangelism to be our Wednesday night class. And then sometime after that, Bruce came to us with a proposal for an entire summer focused on evangelism, building up to Friends and Family Day. And so we did that. But then we came back and looked and said, well, we're going to do kind of evangelism back-to-back. What's that going to look like? And so I got to thinking about what to do, and it certainly doesn't hurt to cover more evangelism, but what we're going to do is cover it from a little different perspective. What we're asking, instead of what does personal evangelism look like, which has been the focus of most of our Sunday night classes, we're asking what does an evangelistic church look like? And that's just a slightly different question. So the focus isn't on what do you personally say to someone when you talk to them. The question is, as a church, how do we make it, I'm going to pick my words here because that's kind of part of the problem. How do we make it as feasible as possible for a person outside of the church to end up inside of the church by way of us? Does that make any sense? But this would be the point of contact based on what we're doing here. Imagine the Glenpool Church of Christ as a black box, and someone lost comes in this way, and a disciple comes out the other side. Right? What does this have to be to make that happen? And so it's a little bit more big picture and less individual. Both of them are essential, right? We're going to have individuals doing individual work and church doing church work to make that work. But this class on Wednesday nights, this quarter, is going to focus on the church part of it. The book I'm using, if anybody's curious, because you know I'm a nerd and I always have to have a book, this is Church Inside Out by Timothy Archer. He's from Churches of Christ in Texas, I believe is where he is, somewhere down that direction, and wrote this book, experience working with churches, some that were growing and some that were not. If this microphone... Can you hear me if I just yell?
Such thing as a healthy church that is not interested in evangelism. works. I even go this far. There's really no such thing as growth, and stagnation, and decay. It's just growth or decay. You're going one way or the other when it comes to churches. Churches don't either, though. Either they're moving or they're not. Okay. So this church was reaching people, and it was healthy. It was healthy, and so it was reaching people. These were busy people. I was told, one of the first things I was taught as a young minister is I was doing some work, and the older fellows said, here's a rule for life. Bring your members out, and they'll stay out of trouble. And what he meant by that was, when people are doing as much as they can in God's service, they don't have time for the other things that we usually get up to that causes problems. When churches are active, they're healthy. When they stop being active, we start doing the other things. Whether it's sin in personal life or bickering and backbiting that we sometimes get up to in churches, all that happens when we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. And so an evangelistic church is a healthy church. A healthy church is an evangelistic church. Those go hand in hand. And then this quote comes from the book itself. In the church in Acts chapter 2, okay, you have some people that are inside the church. And they are clearly interacting with each other, aren't they? Sharing their possessions, they're eating with each other. But they're also reaching, somehow, the people who are outside of the church. Because people are being active. You don't act from the inside. You act from the outside. That's how God acts. So the quote from the book is, if all of the insiders stay in, most of the outsiders will stay out. The only way to get the outsiders into the church is to get the insiders to go out. We must learn to be the church inside out. So the premise of the book is, when the church is active in its mission in the world, going out and doing, then the result is people flowing and being added into the church by God. When the church is internally focused, the folks on the outside stay out, the folks on the inside stay in, and that's where it rests. As I said, that's my well. So, let's take a look then at the particular situation we find ourselves in the American church, and kind of where we have been lulled to sleep into some complacency. We're going to start out with some statistics because I like numbers, so that's fun. Numbers lie, but we'll look at them anyway. Sometimes they occasionally come true. This again comes from the text I'm reading. His first comment is that this isn't your grandfather's culture. And what does he mean by that? What he means by that is most of us recognize there has been and continues to be a fairly emphatic cultural shift, especially in terms of, what do you want to call it, religiousness, right? Or religious values, whatever you want to call it, you pick your name. But that something seems to be moving and not in a good direction, and it has been. So here are some statistics. Pew Research says between 2007 and 2014, the unaffiliated population, that's the people you have on the checklist, and you say, are you Presbyterian, Methodist, Baptist, Catholic, whatever, they mark none of the above, unaffiliated. That population rose from 16.1 to 22.8. So there are less people attached to any kind of a church at all. And that's only a 7-year period. That went up by, what was that, 6%? 6.5%? So as statistics go, that's a fairly dramatic uptick. It makes people very nervous. Gallup says in 2014, 21% believe the Bible to be a purely man-made document. That's up from 13% in 1976. That's a longer period of time. But again, it's, you start looking, if all the arrows point in one direction, right? In any one of them, you say, well, maybe just, that's the problem. But when all the arrows point in one direction, you start to get a little nervous. So revere for the Bible is certainly in decline. And then the Harris poll says between 2009 and 2013, belief in God decreased in just that 4-year period from 82% to 74%. 8% decrease in belief in God in a 4-year period. That number, of those three, is the one that frightens me the most, actually. In a 4-year period, you shouldn't be able to convince that many people of anything. this Harris poll, the percentage of people who believe in God drops from 74% to 64% if you just count people that are between the age of 18 and 36. It's what we call the millennial group. When you look at that age group, the number drops even more dramatically. So who's going to churches? It's not that age group as much. Barna, the religious polling, says 27% of non-Christian millennials consider the Bible to be a dangerous book used to oppress others. Now, that's not just saying it's a man-made product or I don't have an opinion about it. That book is dangerous and I'm against it. More than a quarter of non-Christian millennials, that's a very specific group, but again, that is a number that's a little bit staggering. Those people aren't going to churches. Okay. And then Pew says fewer than 6 in 10 millennials identify themselves as part of any one Christian group. Fewer than 6 in 10, you say, yeah, I go to church at this group. So it's not your grandparents' culture. And you have people that are in the church, but definitely the grandparents. Pew's a play on words there. I mean, insulting. He's just saying, statistically, that group of people, all the arrows are pointing in one direction, and it's not a good direction. So what do we do about that, and how did we get here? Just a little bit of history just to give us an idea of kind of the shift and where we're at. Sometimes you'll hear me use the word the modern world, modernism. I don't know if everyone knows what I mean by modernism when I say it, so I thought I would define it. When I talk about modern, I'm not talking about the 1950s, I'm talking about the 1500s. So everything since the Enlightenment and the 1600s and all that, I'm referred to as the modern world. People start thinking science and Isaac Newton and physics, and of course, physics would be my benchmark for modernism, right? So that's really the modern world, the printing press, right? So in the pre-modern world, and for quite a long time after that, where did religion find itself in culture, whether it's European culture or American culture, or American culture? It was the heart of culture, I mean, quite literally. If you went to a town, what was at the center of the town? The church was a town, right? It was arguing about the kind of people or something. But it was some kind of church that was quite literally at the center of every town. Okay? And so, just by geography, you knew what mattered. And there are a lot of arguments about how much. Early American debates, World War I, were very religious people in the Revolutionary War. They want separation of church and state to some degree. They don't want to be like Europe. And so, you know, there's arguments about what to do with it. But still, even there, you had people with religious convictions and leadership positions in our culture. They were influential voices of the time. Modernism has been the movement for the last several hundred years, that's just been culminating at where we are now, that has questioned the authority of the church and faith. They prefer the church stay out of the business of government. They really prefer the church stay out of the business of education, philosophy, public debate. The eventual goal being, if you have a faith conclusion, you ought to just kind of do that to yourself. The modernist doesn't have a problem with you being religious, just as long as you're quiet. And that's kind of been slowly, we've been a little isolated here in Oklahoma, Bible, but slowly, if you look in Europe, they've been there. They're past this moment. They're done. Slowly, completely move faith out of public life. Modernism emphasizes individualism and rationality from the church. Okay. You need to think for yourself, decide what you want to do, and you don't listen to traditional authority figures like your church. And you can hear that during our culture. For better or worse, sometimes individualism is good. I like it when a guy thinks for himself and works hard. That's good. But you can see where that points people away from trusting some traditional source of knowledge. That church won't deal with its people. Why would I care what they think? I know what it means. And then the result is what sometimes called secularism, where we want a culture where faith has been completely sorted out. Have it if you want to. What's the old quote? friends called believers, this youngest group, they're not even like the parents per se. And that's why we're having such a hard time understanding. Because they don't trust the law of anything. They question the authority of everything. They're disenchanted. They feel like the whole world has let them down. Now, there's pluses and minuses to that point of view. You talk about the title, this and that. But as a role, and as a whole, the group has lost interest in what anyone would have to say about it. Because nothing has worked out well. Modernism was going to build perfect countries with no churches. Right? Perfect human society. And the 20th century was the bloodiest, nastiest century in human history. Fascism, World War I, World War II. Pick the cold war. I mean, it was an ugly era of violence. Does secularism make us all better people? Were we suddenly more moral and we got churches out of our governments? Turns out it actually improved things a lot. So these folks look back at history and they say, okay, we tried that secularism thing. Religion doesn't work. Secularism doesn't work. Nothing works. Who cares? So that's kind of disenchanting folks that were struggling to reach. So when I describe it that way, there's a temptation to be very pessimistic now and disappointed and say, well, burn the whole place down. What do we do, right? There's nothing left. There's no hope. And I would ask instead a different question. I'm hoping you remember, not terribly long ago, I did some preaching from the life of Joseph. If somebody wants to turn to Genesis chapter 45, 4 through 8. Genesis chapter 45, 4 through 8. This is the scene when Joseph, after all the ordeals he's been through, finds himself in Egypt. And meets his brothers. After all they've done to him, Genesis chapter 45, 4 through 8.
Joseph said to his brothers, please come near to me. So they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. Now do not therefore be grieved or angry in yourselves because you sold me here. God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years, famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for your earth, for the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me, but God, and he has made me a father to Pharaoh and the Lord of all his house and ruler throughout all of Egypt.
What Joseph shows us is that it really is up to you how you choose to look at circumstances. He couldn't have, if anybody had a case for complete despair, it's got to be Joseph. And instead, he says, God's still the God of the universe, which means he must be in some way responsible for this, which means there must be something here that is going to be good. It will be faithful. Let's find that. And that's the way he describes the whole city. In fact, it is a theme throughout the Old Testament over and over again that the greater the collapse of the culture or the government or whatever, the worse the problem is, the greater opportunity there is for God's people to be faithful and for God, not him, to do a wonderful thing in that moment in history. Hold my list real quick. Slavery in Egypt gives way to the Exodus, Ten Commandments, the covenant, and all that comes after that. Sins of Israel. Every time they sin, they think, oh, this is it, God's going to wipe them out. And he sends a prophet. And think about what the prophets did. Here we are, literally thousands of years later, we're still reading prophets. And we have that because they were responding to the direction of God, a terrible situation. And something good came out of the words of the prophets. The Babylonian exile moved Israel to solidify its identity. The rise of Rome allowed for the growth of the church. The Romans thought they were killing off the church. The more of us they killed, the more the church grew. And it could be that the moral collapse of our culture can likewise give birth to a renaissance of Christianity. It could flourish now more than it has in decades and centuries. It could be that kind of opportunity if we, like Joseph, choose to be serious about what's going on and what God may be doing. I mentioned that group that's disenchanted. The Bible knows how to talk to disenchanted people who don't want to listen and don't think the Bible has anything to say, that's a harder people to talk about. But people who are just given up and in despair, the Bible knows how to talk about hope.
first task we have tonight, the 15 minutes we have left, is to take a very honest look at ourselves and ask ourselves, what have we done? One of Satan's greatest fears is to allow evil over here to push you into an evil you didn't see over here. The less obvious than that. It's been 30 minutes. I haven't quoted C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis says evil always comes in pairs. The one you see and the one you don't. Evil always comes in pairs. One trying to show you the good. Satan's not done. And I think Charlie wrote. So we need to take a very honest look at ourselves. Part of what we'll do in this class is just look at numbers. Why do we bother looking at numbers? Well, why do you get an annual physical? You go to your doctor, right? Yeah, I'm hoping some of you go to the doctor occasionally, and you get your physical. And they can't tell how much cancer, whether you're healthy or not, but they do the tests, and they give you some numbers. Okay, show of hands. Does anybody actually understand what blood pressure numbers mean? I've had it explained to me a half dozen times, and I still don't know. I ask every time, is that good? They would give me, I can calculate cell reflux, I can, you know, talk about gravity weight, but give me blood pressure numbers, I don't know. I still have to ask, what does that mean? It's just numbers to me. But to a doctor, they hear that number, it means something, and they can say, this is what it tells me about you. This is what cholesterol tells me. That mean old man tells me about my weight every time I go in, as if I hadn't noticed. And he brings it up every time. Okay. My doctor uses the numbers in the present to predict the future, to warn me of what might happen if I continue doing what I'm doing. My doctor says things that are negative to keep my health positive. He says, fat boy, lose some weight so that I don't die. And so what Archer suggests in this book is that churches from time to time need to go through the painful process of really looking at themselves in the painful mirror of scripture and in reality and saying, what have we become and what should we be? When we do that, there are a couple of options. So think back to taking the physical of the doctor for a moment. You can disagree with the doctor and get a second opinion. Look at that. You know, it's perfectly legitimate thing to do. Because it turns out doctors are wrong sometimes. Yeah. Now, there's a reason you're not a doctor. You are supposed to trust the guy with the white coat, but it's okay to ask a second. We do that sometimes. Likewise, in this class, I may make an evaluation of our congregation that you may think, well, that's fair. I think we're a little more like this, a little less like that, or I think we can do this okay, not like that. And that's fine. We can get a second opinion. That's a lot. We can make changes. We can say, well, I do need to lose weight. Instead of getting a second opinion, I can decide he's right. But a scale is just saying what it says every time. And I can do something about it. Okay? That's not the church. We can say, well, that's a fair point about us. What are we going to do about that? What we cannot do is rationalize away what we want. When I say cannot, I mean must not. If I just keep telling the doctor, I don't weigh the same as other people. I have really heavy shoes. I'm big bone.
It's a thyroid.
It's a thyroid. Now, I can say whatever I want. Eventually, I'm going to have my heart attack. And it's not going to matter what my rationalization is. You want the comparison here? As a church, it's very easy to kind of rationalize the situation. Well, we would be growing, or we would be doing this, but, you know, hey. And we kind of just push aside and move on. That's the least healthy thing we can do. So this class is designed to be a healthy, and in some ways, confrontational in a good way, look in the mirror to say, what are we doing, what are we not doing? And then make individual steps, and then steps as a group, trying to do things better. So step one, the hardest thing I had to do in preparation for this class was to take this one. So in the little workbook, and he was really cruel. He published a book and the workbook, so in case you weren't sure, he asked the questions you were supposed to be asking. And I took out the workbook and I started to kind of go through it and ask the questions that he asked about our church. And it was a pushing in a certain direction, I ought to have some of that. I don't want to pay as much attention. As far as moral compass and direction, that's part of my job. So if it's not even done, especially if it's like a line item in my job, those are challenging questions for me to look at myself. And then tonight, my goal is to write some of these down and try to look at them as a group. So, he has a 7-point list of questions. You may not like his list, you make your own. But we're going to go through it for 10 minutes. 7-point list, take our physical as a congregation. And I'm going to give you Ben's opinion about the answer to these questions. You're allowed to have your own in your head. Get a second opinion, or a third, or a fourth, or a 200, if you want. But this is just my take on it as a way to start the conversation into the integration. Okay. Question one was about membership. What word would you use to describe your membership number-wise? It would obviously be up or down, right? Growing, shrinking, increasing the viewers. Okay. This one was a tricky one. Because I know I've been to a lot of congregations where it's an easy answer, decline. We have all been members of someplace, somewhere, I suspect, that knew what decline was about. I remember when we got to Glenpool and things started kind of going well, I made the comment to Celine, I've never been in a church that was growing before, I'm not sure what happens. And that was like a bittersweet reality. I've always been in congregations that think kind of plateaued and were in progression. So this is the place for progression. Sorry. However, I didn't give myself the out on this one, but the easy answer. Increasing would have been a very easy answer. And I decided to try and be honest instead. Anybody remember Josh Harris' lesson on a Sunday night? Sheep rustling. My friend on the blog used to call it. Sheep rustling. Is that there is a difference between growth in the kingdom sense and growth in the numerical sense. As a minister and as a member, it is very, very easy to pat ourselves in the back and look at the numbers and say, clearly we're doing it right, just look at the numbers. But that honest look at the mirror says, what else do we not see? So, what should mean hard, in case you care to know, when I was preparing the slides for Thanksgiving a year ago, the slides, and we show all the new members, and we show all the baptisms, we had 37 members. I couldn't have myself on that, but we had 2 baptisms. And that disturbed me deeply, to the point where my favorite Tuesday night of the year, Bobby, is Thanksgiving week, when we have our special Thanksgiving service. And I almost had trouble enjoying it, because in preparation for that, I thought, and then what are you going to do for 37 new members, 2 baptisms? One of those, and no offense to the capable, one of them grew up, right? I mean, Mark, you've been here for a few years. You're number 2, and I'm super proud of you, right? I counted you 10 times, but the point is, I mean, while that's wonderful and we celebrate, there's no shrinking those 2. Those 2 matter. At the same time, you say, it would be easy to mislead ourselves about the number. So when I evaluated this, when I got the membership, I used the word swelling. Because I couldn't bring myself to use the word growing. It seemed like cheating. So the honesty part of that, nothing wrong with adding members. Nothing wrong with adding members that continue to grow and be healthy here. Maybe they can be healthier here than they are somewhere else. That's all good. But I can't allow myself to fall in the trap of saying one is equal to the other. Because that is going to make me stagnant. I just look and say, hey, 37 new members. You know, I'm going to feel much better about what I'm doing than I should. Next question was attendance. This was another one. Remember that line on the previous slide, don't rationalize the way things? I immediately started rationalizing where I did because I can say very easily, I'm a numbers guy, numbers are up. That's easy. Numbers have been going up for years. Okay? Easy. The numbers are not, however, very consistent. I'm good friends with Grant Sullivan over at 4560. And he was over here one Sunday, and he was having a program on statistically, young families are busier and less consistent in attendance than older, more settled people. That's just a fact. In every congregation I've ever, you've got a lot of young families, so we're going to have a lot of inconsistencies. I said, but that was kind of me giving myself a pass and saying, oh, don't worry about that. I'm afraid of that. Rather than saying, what can we do to help develop consistency when we don't have, you know, 30 or 40% swing in attendance among the events, never mind the other events and times and services that we have. So the word I use for that is inconsistent. I wasn't happy yet. Also, not bad. It's inconsistent.
Are you only looking at Sunday morning, too?
And for the purpose of this exercise, I was looking at Sunday morning. I said, if you look at the other events, you see additional data that you say, well, why, what is going on there as well? Average age was the next one he asked. Again, very label. I felt really good about that. A lot of churches have been to average age, maybe it could be 65 to be the answer in the group, right? A lot of churches really do have an age discrepancy. Down at FedEx, they call Bill the Kid. But no, a lot of churches really, there is a pretty good thing. Here, staggering numbers as far as our young families group. Something like 30 kids and 30 adults make up our young families group. On a given Sunday, about a third of the people in the building will be children. And that's no surprise. I remember the first retreat we had, men's group out at Frog Road, Jeff. You somehow got hoodwinked to get a lesson. And I remember, to this day, see, he's a good work on, the median age of Lindpool at that time was like 30, 31 years old. Of the community, town. So what would you expect? The median age of church to be one person to go in that branch. Young community, young church. So again, I was ready to pat myself on the back. But then I also observed this that I thought was worth noticing. I actually have two distinct layers in this congregation when it comes to age. We have a very large population of what we might call our senior saints or slightly denial saints. Whoever you are, call yourself whoever you are. And then we have a very active and busy young families group. There's a big gap in between. Okay. That 35 to 55 range, by the numbers, there's a dip there. Pretty dramatic. Which is telling. Where would you notice that? That is where traditionally church leadership comes from. See, the young families are typically too young to be elders, and the senior saints typically are done with that. So, look, somebody else is it. Typically, you get your elders from that in between group. Okay. And so we've got 15 deacons with the elders. Because in that age group, there's a generation or half a generation that's kind of missing. And this is, again, not rationalized away, but I know a lot of churches like this, where there's kind of two groups. Somewhere, something went bad. Something went sideways, and there's about 20 years of people missing, a lot of churches. And we fall into that, too. So leadership-wise, that's where you're feeling those. Because you're looking for those experienced, veteran Christians who are in good health, they're at a point in their career where they have enough free time to do something in leadership in the church. That's a pretty narrow age bracket, and that's the one that is typically missing here, I am fair. So, to be honest, again, I know there's kind of a two-layer kind of gap, but to be fair, it tells something about who we are. Level of involvement, the phrase I use with hit bitterness. Sometimes we do something around here, and we have to beach off of the sit. We're so excited to get involved, and it's just like, wow, these are wonderful people. And then sometimes we do something and it's the opposite of that, right? That really is hit or miss. Again, that's not abnormal. Most churches are like that. But if we were going to talk evaluating. That one, I just put not high. It was actually vague and unhelpful. I don't know that we have made a visible impact in the community. And the way I answered that question was to ask myself, how many people would I have to ask, what do you know about the Glenville First Prize before they tell me? Believe it or not, when I talk to people, I like to introduce myself as, I'm minister at the Glenville First Prize. You guys got that sign over there on Hill. It's a great sign. And that's about as far as people know. We've got a good building, we've got a good sign, they know where we're at. They got us down to Elwood, which is a plus. I mean, you could be, where are you guys? It's better than not. But as far as awareness, I want people to know something about us other than there's a nice little building over there. I would like them to be aware of something else about us. And then the seventh one is related to that. Influence the community. I really had no idea how to answer that. There's some kind of influence the church doesn't. You know, I have no interest in the Glenville Church Christ being a political power broker in Glenville and the mayor and the text my call. I didn't talk to her once in a while, but it doesn't ask me about anything. We don't have that kind of influence, but there is other kind of influence. Are we an influence for good?